It is finally Friday, and thank goodness, because it has been a week of heavy news. But we are ready to talk about it with you on our Week in Review. Here in Massachusetts, we mark 6 months of life locked down in a coronavirus state of emergency.
The last 6 months, we all know, has been a tremendous struggle against COVID-19 in so many ways, and it's been especially tough on local downtowns, main streets, and the businesses in each of our Commonwealth's communities.
Governor Charlie Baker there yesterday. Now, the six-month mark comes as colleges and universities struggle with welcoming students back, and local schools begin the challenging process of reopening. Here's Needham High School teacher Max Heckler.
I'm just really trying to prepare what I'm going to teach as that continues to change. It's a challenge. It's exciting. And I worry how parents are doing.
Meanwhile, a City of Boston task force on police suggests serious reforms as families demand justice for those killed at the hands of police. Here's Jennifer Root Bannon at a statehouse protest, quoting body camera footage of the five officers and one state trooper who fatally shot her brother Justin 26 times in February.
I killed the mother F. I emptied my magazine on him. Do these sound like comments of people who were just afraid for their life? No!
So much pain and loss and reckoning, and we consider it all against the backdrop of today's 19th anniversary of September 11th.
10. Huh. Raise that! Ha!
So join us for this Week in Review. Reflect on all of it with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our panelists this week, first we have Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend Mariama, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
And also with us is Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Good to have you back as well, Richard.
Happy to be here. How you doing?
Well, thanks for asking. It is quite a week, and I think let's start with September 11th, because that is the backdrop today against which we'll consider everything else we talk about. Yesterday on Radio Boston, we spoke with Mitch Zuckoff, professor in narrative studies at Boston University and author of The Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11. Here's how he reflected on the two tragedies then and now.
We're experiencing now a 9/11 level tragedy every 3 days, with 3,000 deaths every 3 days in this COVID crisis. And so I'm thinking, what is this going to mean for the national character? What is it going to mean for who we are as a people, who we are as a community, who we are as a country? We're reacting differently, at least, than we did in the immediate aftermath of 9/11.
Reverend Mariama, how are you finding yourself thinking about the anniversary this year?
Yeah, I mean, I resonate a lot with that. I mean, I think this year has just been one of intense loss. And I think 2020 has made me really ask both who are we and who do we want to be? And I think that that's one of the questions that I think this question of who we want to be is one we asked in 9/11. I'm not sure that we maybe did as much soul searching. And I think on this day, I think that's a big question that we need to struggle with. And I will say, given everything that's happened, I'm thinking about it a lot today.
And how about you, Richard?
Well, I think it's amazing when you think about it, that there's a whole generation of kids who have been born, who have come of age since that happened, because I think a lot of people think, those of us who were, you know, older, it doesn't seem like that long ago. And, you know, and it was, in a way, you know, as bad as it was afterwards, the country really came together. And you know, every day that goes by that you see all the division going on, you know, you look back at right after, and there was just, you know, a lot of patriotism, a lot of consensus, and hopefully we can get back to that national feeling at one point. you know, and recognize that we're all in this together and that we do live in a great country and it's worth, you know, there are people who want to destroy us and, you know, it's worth defending all the freedoms that we have.
You know, we in Boston and in the Commonwealth, not by choice, but had a particular role and a particular loss in the 9/11 experience, both then and again in 2013 as victims of the next attack here on U.S. soil. And then we also had a particular role in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, an early super spreading event, high rates of infection early on and groping our way through figuring out how to respond, one of the early states to have to do that. I find myself thinking, there's something profound about our out front or first experience role in both of these crises. Does that say something about who we are in Boston and in Massachusetts, Mariama?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the truth is in both of these instances, it does feel a little like it happened to us. But I do think both in this crisis and in 9/11, it was an opportunity to lean into our humanity a little bit more and to stand with each other. And I will say, as divisive as the response to the pandemic has been, I feel like it's been less so in Massachusetts. And I say I feel like it because I haven't been doing very much traveling. Usually I'm around the country a little bit more month over month. And these days I've been in New England all the time. But it did feel like, and I do feel like we as a Commonwealth have come together around COVID. We've mourned together and remembered together. It doesn't necessarily feel like that at the national level. So I'm not sure that the sentiment I feel here has played any leadership role in shifting how things have been nationally. But I am proud of the way we've responded on the whole.
We're doing our Week in Review with Reverend Mariama White-Hammond and Richard Tissé. And you can join us to reflect on the news of the week at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard, I mentioned the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing a minute ago, and, you know, we ran the next year. And as you know, this year, for the first time in history, we didn't. But the virtual marathon started last Saturday. How are you reflecting on the loss of that kind of ritual, such an important institution for our region this time around?
It's really, I mean, when you think about it, that, you know, it's gone off every year without any interruption. Historically, you know, all the things that have happened over the years have still managed to pull it off. And, you know, here we are, with it happening virtually this year. And I think that's, you know, it's a good, it's symbolic, I think, of some of the changes that everybody's had to make and just how, you know, all-encompassing this whole pandemic has been as far as changing people's rituals and people's, things that they'd normally do. I mean, even to watch a baseball game with the stadium empty is something crazy about that. You know, it just doesn't seem normal. So I think people are trying to do the best they can and working around, our new normal, I guess. But, you know, and really hoping that we are at the point where things will start to get back to normal.
So let's stay with this new normal idea, because we are 6 months yesterday into a state of emergency, into a kind of lockdown life here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Looking back on the last 6 months, did we do the right thing? Have we done it right? Have we struck the right balance between public health and the economy and freedom of movement? Reverend Mariama.
Yeah, I mean, I like I said, on the whole, I think we have. I mean, I do think we still need to recognize that there are communities that have been disproportionately impacted. And I do wonder if we could have done more. I think early on, that super spreader event probably happened because we, like many states, didn't adequately prepare for what was possible. I think we have avoided what other people in the world have experienced. I remember, you know, I've seen particularly Asian travelers going through the airport with masks on years before this. And, you know, had an opportunity to learn a little bit about what people experienced with SARS before. And we just have never been impacted like that. But I think on the whole, I think we've had to walk a fine line. The area I am slightly concerned as someone who lives in Boston and is around a lot of the schools is whether or not the universities should have reopened. We are not going to know yet. Many of them have just had students in the relatively short term last week or so. That is one area where I'm, again, as someone who's not far from some of those campuses, a little concerned about. I
want us to talk about universities, Reverend Mariama. There's a chunk of time I'd like us to spend on that. But before we do, I want to follow up on the first thing you said and ask Richard a specific question here. Also, listeners, I want to hear what you think 6 months in. Are you feeling like we've handled it well? Are you feeling like we struck the right balance? 800-423-8255. Richard, the Supreme Judicial Court this morning heard oral arguments in a case that challenged the governor's executive orders, the business closures. The plaintiff's lawyers are arguing that Massachusetts state law on these issues doesn't specifically mention a pandemic, but the governor's lawyers argued that he has sufficiently broad authority to do what he's done. In your capacity as a former state lawmaker, what is your read of that situation?
Well, we're obviously in unprecedented times, and I would give the governor really high marks for leading us through this because it's just unprecedented. That said, you know, I don't think we have ever in the history of the Commonwealth had a governor who has exerted the power that this governor has to deal with a pandemic. And, you know, he was able to use a civil defense law from the 1950s to be able to do it. And I do think that one of the things, one of the takeaways and things that we need to deal with, I think long term about, is should the governor have just unlimited power in a situation like this? Does the legislature have a role to play? Should the legislature, you know, when a state of emergency is declared, should it be, you know, that the legislature has to reauthorize it every 30 or 60 days so that they're involved? So I do think looking down the road, we should think about this experience. And then just as to your, you know, basic question, I think there are a lot of businesses, you know, closing everything down was probably easier than reopening things. And there are a lot of businesses that haven't reopened or reopened with a lot of conditions that have made it really difficult for them to stay open. And
what do you mean by that, Richard? I want to stop you there because I'm not sure I'm imagining what you mean correctly. What do you mean by saying it was easier to close than to reopen?
Well, we have the highest unemployment rate right now in the entire country, and that is due, you know, in part to the severity of the shutdown in Massachusetts, and the fact that a lot of businesses weren't able to reopen on the same schedule that others in other states were able to. So it's definitely had an impact on the state. And again, when you close everything down, you can just do it, you know. But when you're reopening, all of these businesses have had a lot of protocols, you know, and strings attached to their reopening that's made it really hard to do business. And, you know, there's a balance. I think, again, I'd give the governor high marks because this has never happened before, but it's also, you know, a good learning experience. And we can't forget that there are people who have lost everything, small business owners, that are out of business right now. Look at all the restaurants and bars closing in Boston, for instance. It's a problem.
So let's talk about the continued struggle with how to balance our way through this state of emergency, this pandemic. Reverend Mariama, a little bit ago, you expressed some concern as a resident of Boston about how the universities are doing this. I want to play a little sound for you here. This is Kelly Chan. She is a Northeastern student and the editor of the school's independent newspaper, student paper. And she is speaking to CNN this week about the mood on campus following Northeastern's dismissal of 11 freshmen after they did not appropriately gather in social distance.
One side of the story is like, oh, university is justified in holding these students accountable for their actions. And on the other hand, was this too harsh of a punishment? You know, they are, you know, just freshmen. This was one mistake. And freshmen were put in a very tough situation. You know, we always come to college campuses expecting to make new friends, to socialize. You know, it can be tempting to gather and wanted to salvage that college experience. So I think definitely a lot of people feel for the students.
So as people know, the parents have obtained lawyers. I feel like if we still had water coolers that we all went to, this would sort of be the water cooler question of the week. Listeners, I want to know what you think about the Northeastern 11. Did the university do the right thing? 800-423-8255. Reverend Mariama, water cooler question. Did they do the right thing?
I think this is a really hard question, because for me, on one hand, I feel like we're being slightly unrealistic about how responsible young people or anyone can be in this situation. As an example, there were members of our church who really wanted to get back together, but I went to one gathering and I saw how hard it was for me personally to follow the rules once I started seeing people. I mean, people I hadn't seen in months, and I my instinct was to give them a hug. And then I was like, oh, wait, no, we can't do that, right? So I think there is some piece in which I feel like we are not being honest with ourselves about our ability to maintain distancing, because it's not human nature to stand 6 feet away from people and elbow bump and not get excited when somebody says something funny, right? That's just not normal. So I think that there was some piece of this was unrealistic. At the same time,
Richard, I have an organization.
And sometimes, and I think this is possibly part of what happened, when you make a rule and young people test it, sometimes I was in the difficult position of having to say, if I let it slide one time, it's going to send the message to everyone that we're going to let it slide. And if something is a life or death issue, then you may need to send a very clear signal that you won't let it slide. I think it is unfortunate, and I'm hoping that these young people are given a second chance. Maybe they're allowed to start again next year. I don't know, but I understand that there is some difficulty around letting things slide when the consequences are so high.
And my understanding is that they would, I believe, have an opportunity in future semesters. Richard, there was so much about what Reverend Mariama just said that resonated with me. I have a freshman at BU who was in my belly during 9/11. So this is her first crisis. And she's worried that her generation is going to be treated as being on the wrong side of history for wanting to be on campus. Will they be?
You know, I feel bad. I mean, these are all the kids who missed out on their graduation. You know, now they're going to college. And I have a good friend whose daughter just went to Gettysburg College. And it's like a prison, basically. You know, when you go to college, you want to be mingling. You want to be meeting people, you know. And you really can't do any of that right now. So I feel bad, you know. And it's funny, when you hear kids being expelled from college, it's usually, you know, for having a keg party or fraternity hijinks or, you know, things like that, not wearing a mask. I mean, it's pretty severe. So, and I get it, you have to make rules, but I really think that, you know, at the very least, given it's the beginning of the semester, they should at least get a refund. I mean, for $36,000, you know, the school, I don't think the school's doing the right thing by keeping the money. I don't think that's the right thing at all to do.
And that has been a big bone of contention on this. The university is keeping everybody's first semester tuition. Let's talk about schools themselves now. Not that universities aren't schools, but we're thinking so hard about primary education now. And as we do that, I'd like to go to a call. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephanie's on the line from Brookline. Stephanie, what are you thinking about? Stephanie, do we have you? I think we must have lost Stephanie there, so we'll come back to calls. Maybe we'll be able to get Stephanie back on the line. Oh, do we have you now, Stephanie?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me now?
There we go. Yeah, it's the joys of COVID broadcasting, Stephanie. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, no problem. Just want to raise a quick point, which is that these are not 3 years old or 5 years old. These are young adults. It's time for them to grow up and own up to the consequences of their action and decisions. You know, they might think that it's harsh, but hey, this is harsh times, and they are not the only one, who can, get a pass when, everybody else, could bear the consequences. That's all I want to say.
Thanks for that, Stephanie. We had another caller who wanted to talk about the universities as well. Tom's on the line from Framingham. Tom, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My feeling is that on the one hand, I agree that students should be held accountable and they should face consequences for jeopardizing not just their own health, but that of the whole campus community. And on the other hand, my feeling is, let's get real. From a public health standpoint, all colleges and universities should be fully remote. And they're not, because they know that they can't justify their tuition rates if they're just providing the same kind of online learning or distance learning that you can get at a community college or elsewhere. And so we pack a bunch of 18 to 22-year-olds who have been cooped up at home for the last 6 months into close quarters on college campuses, which, let's face it, are cruise ships on land. And then we blame them when they turn around and act exactly the way we'd expect them to. So I feel like we're trying to have it both ways, and it's just not feasible.
Thanks for that, Tom. I appreciate it. And I'm going to give Tom and Stephanie the last word there, because I do want to spend a little bit of time before we go to a break on primary school as well, because teachers across the state began reporting this week. Most districts open next week. There's this big question of whether or not we're ready. And I want to play a little sound for you, because on Tuesday we spoke with Takeru Nagayoshi, who goes by TK, and he's an English and research teacher at New Bedford High School and the 2020 Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. I was very interested to hear what he had to say. And he talked about how uncertainty around the school year is impacting him as a teacher.
It's really hard to plan for something that you don't know how things are going to look like, how our classroom setup looks like, what our remote learning options are, whether or not we're clear on our expectations, both with our parents and our students. And we're all trying to find information, but everything just seems to be scattered, and it's really hard to concentrate, let alone plan. And so I feel like a bundle of mess, and my head is all over the place.
Reverend Mariama, how ready should we be, and how much should we know? Or is the situation TK is describing just the way it's got to be right now?
Yeah, so I think my sister is a teacher, and I we're just the two siblings, so we talk pretty frequently. And I think one of the big challenges first was not knowing how things were going to be set up till the very last minute. I think if teachers had this information, say, in July, it wouldn't have made it easy, but they would have had some time to wrap their heads around that and begin to plan. Finding out how your school is going to be set up 2 weeks before you're expected to be, teaching is really challenging. So, I think this is an example of, I understand that we tried to wait as long as possible so that there was if we could be back in person, that would be facilitated by waiting. But this is a place where I think the state kind of got it wrong. I think we probably needed to make the call earlier so that people could plan and teach effectively. And I'm concerned that lots of teachers will not be able to be effective because they're going to be making it up as they go along because they didn't get the time that they needed to prepare.
And Richard, at the heart of the tension around that, it seems to be a lot of questions around safe enough and who's defining what safe enough is in the schools, when we're going to get to that point. And it seems like it's really hard to get to a common answer on that. Is there a way for us to do that?
Well, this is going to be touch and go for a while. I mean, we're just going to have to feel our way through it. And, there isn't really a one-size-fits-all solution. I mean, every district in the state is different. There are, some communities have a lot of challenges with their facilities, and their ventilation and air conditioning systems. There are others that just have space problems, and, social distancing takes space. So, you have schools that are in hot spots, community-wise, as far as infections go. So you have a lot, you know, and then you have school districts where the district and the teachers union work hand in hand, and others where they really don't work well together, you know, and all of these issues are factors, and it makes really every district different around the state. So we're just going to have to feel our way through and see what works and what doesn't. And, you know, and as the governor always says, follow the science and, you know, let the science dictate where we go from here.
I'm going to take a break in just a second. It's just about time to do so, but I do want to get one caller voice in to take us out into that break. So we've got 800-423-8255. We've got Dave on the line from Yarmouth. Dave,
hi,
microphone's
hi guys. The bottom line is, until they open the schools, normal society cannot begin. Until the schools are open full-time, that way parents can go back to their jobs in person, because I know a lot of companies don't want to put the pressure on their employees because they have to take care of their kids at home. It shows that society is able to handle it. And until we do that, that's not going to happen. And as far as who determines how that's safe enough, Tiziana, it's right now it's the teachers unions. Any place that's been a really big push-off, they've said it's not safe enough.
Still with us remotely are our panelists, Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate, and of course you. Join us. We're going to talk next about police reform, police violence in Massachusetts, and city politics. Call us and share your thoughts. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And as we jump into our new subjects, I do want to stay. We had tweets. We had callers on the line. Schools, universities are something that people continue to want to talk about, and we will continue to do that here on Radio Boston. But there is some other important stuff that happened this week. You know, police reform had, to some extent, faded from view here in the Commonwealth in the last few weeks, even though instances of police brutality against Black men around the country most certainly didn't. And I want to cue up four major events around police reform this week. First, DA Marion Ryan released 400 pages of documents on the police killing of Uri Stamps by Framingham Police in 2011. Police body camera footage released and the Norfolk County DA defending a finding from the February killing of Justin Root that police were justified in that killing. That happened this week. A rally at the State House to maintain momentum against systemic racism, including a call to open old case files of police actions, and a task force on police reform released its recommendations to Marty Walsh. And I find myself thinking, could all of that have ever happened in a single week in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts before now, Reverend Mariama?
No, I think we are clearly in an unprecedented time. I think we are in a moment, and I have to say, I'm not sure that without COVID, it would be getting this much attention. I think all of us have been home. All of us have felt our vulnerability on a level we've never had before. And I think that many of us viscerally felt the outrage around what happened to George Floyd specifically. So I do think this is unprecedented. I am not quite sure what the outcome will be. I think there was a lot of energy in June and July, but then in August, there was a lot less energy from protesters and a lot more energy from police unions actively lobbying, having their own rallies, ad in the Boston Globe. In August, it was starting to look to me that we were gonna move away from major reforms, and now maybe the pendulum is swinging back to more of what had been in June and July. So yes, it has been.
Let me jump. Yeah, and I want to jump in there because I want to turn that specifically to Richard as a former state legislator. Is that why we don't have legislation passed at the State House? And will we this year, do you think?
Well, I think we're definitely going to have something passed this year. The House and the Senate have both passed their own versions of police reform, and there's a conference committee that's been appointed that's, you know, that's working out a final version, and you'll probably see something, I would think, you know, sometime in October. And, you know, I do think, obviously what happened with George Floyd cast a light on some of the techniques and things that are wrong with police. But I haven't really heard, you know, that we have a huge problem in Boston. There are probably incidents that people can point to, but all in all, you know, I have you know, most public policy people look at the Boston police force as a pretty good, you know, force as far as, you know, as far as being ahead of the curve on different things, you know, like de-escalation and community policing and items like that. So, you know, we want to make sure that there's always room for improvement, but we want to be careful that we don't, you know, turn the department upside down and prevent them from doing their job, which is to protect the public.
Well, listeners, where do you come out on this? At 800, hang on just a second, Reverend Mariama, let me put this number out, 800-423-8255, to let us know where you come out on this. Thanks, Reverend Mariama. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think it's not just about Boston. The Springfield Police Department is under investigation by the Department of Justice and has a terrible record. So I think one of the challenges is the notion that the police challenge is only with big city policing, and that's absolutely not true. Around the country, we see that sometimes suburban police departments, we had an instance coming out about the Newton Police Department pulling six guns on someone. There are a series of challenges, and I want to be careful because I think the challenge is systemic. And quite frankly, I am not sure that all of the problem is with the police. I think if you look at historically, we have asked the police to over-police people of color. That is not something that they just made up. That's something that our society condoned for quite a while. And so I don't think that they did that practice on their own. If we want something different, and I think we are at a tipping point where many of us do want something different, then the structures and the rules need to change for the police in order to make sure that they do not continue in the path that, quite frankly, many of us in this country condoned for centuries. We have opportunities to shift.
I want to give two specific examples here. I'm going to play some sound for you guys on both. The first is that Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan came out with more than 400 pages of documents related to the 2011 police killing of Uri Stamps, a black man in his home in Framingham. This is to Reverend Mariama's point about not just the big city forces. We spoke with Selvin Chambers earlier this week. He's a friend of the Stamps family, and he talked about how he thought about justice regarding the firing of the officer involved.
If justice is he loses his job and he's no longer in that, we want justice. Justice was not done. Having a civil case settled out of court, you know, and giving money to people for loss of a loved one, you can never put a price on someone's life, right?
And we're also reconsidering another instance. This was a shooting of Justin Root in February. Protesters gathered at the State House on Wednesday, and one of them speaking was Jennifer Root Bannon. We had her here on Radio Boston several weeks ago. She is the sister of Justin Root, who was shot and killed by law enforcement in February. Here she is at the State House.
After they executed him, they made disgusting comments. I killed the mother F. I empty my magazine on him. Don't say nothing to nobody. Do these sound like comments of people who were just afraid for their life? No!
And you can hear her intense anger there. Interestingly, the Norfolk District Attorney Michael Morrissey Thursday released pages of documents and defended his finding from February that the fatal police shooting was justified. What does it say, Richard, that we are at this moment where we may still be litigating, but we are in fact litigating previous cases of police shootings, police actions against two different cases here, one a black man and one a man with a history of mental illness?
Well, it's a tough situation, but I think both of them are exceptions rather than the rule, you know? And again, you can always... There's always room for improvement, and both of these cases, you know, should be looked at. But I don't, you know, it's sad that the impression's being given out that the police do this, you know, are involved in these type of situations on a daily basis. That isn't what is going on right now in the state and, you know, maybe other parts of the country, but our police,
you know, are doing the best job that they can. And I, you know, and
Richard,
I understand.
What makes you think that we've got the impression that this is happening on a daily basis? What makes you think that that's the impression people are getting in the Commonwealth?
Well, because we're going back now to every case, you know, that's come up, and that's what you see in the news, and that's what you hear, you know, and people, and, you know, I think a lot of the people who are protesting right now are, you know, protesting against police brutality, and I don't think that, you know, in my town of Wakefield, you don't see police brutality. You know, there's, I mean, not all police, you know, the police are trying to do the best job that they can, and again, there's room for improvement. There should be, you know, in our state, we don't have a system in place that if you're a bad police officer, you, our certification process, so if, you know, you're a bad police officer, you can get your certification taken away by the state. That's a really good, you know, reform that everybody should get behind. I just think we have to be careful. You know, we shouldn't be defunding and dismantling the police. We should be trying to improve the police, you know, and do what we can to make things better.
All right. So I want to give Reverend Mariama a chance to respond there, and then I want to go to a call.
I can't speak to the particulars of the Wakefield police, but here's what I can say, that the majority of America had no idea this was going on. And the only reason we know and are having this conversation is because people are walking around with cameras on their phone. This, what we are experiencing now, is the reality I have lived my entire life. I have been talked to inappropriately by the police. I have seen them rough people up, including people that I know and love. So with all due respect, Richard, I'm glad that your experience is different. What I'm saying is I think in this moment, many of us who have had a different experience for our entire lives finally have a tool in our disposal to show that experience to other people. And that's why this conversation is happening. I don't think it's new, and I don't think it's uncommon. Does every time you die? No. But do people get roughed up by the police on a pretty regular basis? Absolutely.
Lots of calls here, 800-423-8255. Let's go to Oliver in Watertown. Oliver, go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to respond to Richard's point about his idea that this is not some sort of daily occurrence or a common occurrence in Massachusetts, and this is simply some sort of issue that is occurring other places in the country. I disagree with that completely. I think Massachusetts, as someone that has lived in Massachusetts for only a few years and it came from another part of the country, Massachusetts is not a state that has a good reputation of police oversight or any sort of due diligence as far as police misconduct. There's an exceptional amount of protection given to police officers in this state where police officers are even remain receiving their pension for years and years after misconduct due to whatever you want to call it, corruption in the police or any other form of state government. There is an exceptional
amount. So Oliver,
amount of-
let me take it back from you there. I feel like we've got the gist of what you're saying, and I don't want to miss this before we go to a break. So let me give Richard a chance to respond. Thanks for calling in to talk to Richard about that. Richard, go ahead.
No, I understand what people are saying, and there are things. I mean, there's always room for improvement, whether it's, you know, more de-escalation training, better community policing, strengthening the use of force policies. There are a lot of things that we can do. I just, you know, I think you have to be careful. Again, I hear all this, let's defund the police and send in social workers. You know, you need the police. You know, and they're on our side, they're on the public side, and, you know, and if the changes that need to be made, so be it, but we shouldn't look at them as the enemy. They're there to help people.
Back to you, Reverend Mariama.
Yeah, and I'm thankful that that's your lived experience. I think what a lot of people are saying is that isn't our lived experience, that they are on our side.
I want to point out to the two of you, and I'm not going to have time to go to these calls because I would want to give them time to kind of really breathe, and we're short. But we have callers in queue who are calling in to tell us their stories of encounters with police that were frightening and were disturbing. And I just want you to know that those voices are out there. Let me turn back to the two of you to have more of your conversation with each other.
I mean, I could share my own experiences. You know, nowadays, if I'm in a collar, obviously people don't come at me the same way. But as a Black woman, older, the fact that I still sometimes experience that means I know it happens to young people, young Black men, young Latino men on a regular basis. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've sometimes pulled over when I see something happening just to watch. And I've had police officers tell me that they have the right to arrest me for watching. Now, I know my rights. And I say to them, I'm watching. And if you're doing the right thing, I'll be able to say that too. Right. And so I'm saying the reality is different people have very different lived experiences with the police.
That's all right. Let me get one more. I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut short your experience there. I really don't. I want to get one more call in. Glenn, keep it tight, please. Glenn from Maynard. Go ahead.
Hi. The thought that occurred to me is that we have a lot of problems in our society, in our culture, including mental health problems, poverty, homelessness, that we've avoided addressing, and we've dumped all these things in the laps of the police and said, here, you take care of it.
Thanks for that, Glenn. I'm sorry, I'm going to stop you there.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, thank you. And so Glenn's point, and this is something I think we've talked about on air and we're going to talk about more in the future, is allocation of services as well. And Richard, we're low on time. We did get recommendations from a task force in the city this week. One of the things that it suggested was considering reallocation where necessary and to increase training on implicit bias for the Boston Police Force. Do we need to think about how we're spending our money on things that have been relegated to the police?
I agree with the caller. I mean, the police are expected to do everything right now. I don't know who would want to do that job because it's no win. I do think, that the task force that came out with great recommendations, and we should probably follow the recommendations, at least in Boston to help try to make the force better.
And Reverend Mariama, last word on that. Your reactions to the recommendations.
It's not just Boston. This is systemic, and we need to make sure that everywhere in the state, people are doing the best they can.
Well, thank you to both of you for the lively conversation. That's been Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Thank you. And Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate, thanks to you as well.